Hunky Dory was actually the first, I think, taste of an image of David Bowie, of where the image had completely changed from, say, 2 years before. Were you conscious of that image? Were you pursuing that image at that stage?
No, I just treated it from album to album. I mean, it just changed drastically with the kind of song that I was writing.
Right.
As I was going through a sort of, I thought it was some of my best songwriting at that time. So I became a Renaissance man with a pre-Raphaelite kind of look.
Right.
But that was sort of tongue-in-cheek.
And the critics at that stage started to take a lot of notice. How much notice did you take of the critics at that stage?
I was aware that I had a good chance of making my songs known, but it was how I was going to present them, which was the age-old problem that I had. And that was Ziggy Stardust really solved that.
Hi, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. Thanks for joining us. And thank you all who were in touch after our last episode, in which Charlotte Hadley made a wonderful case for the much maligned Tin Machine. And it's really good to hear from so many Tin Machine aficionados out there who enjoyed the episode. So now I'm kind of chewing over the possible ways in which I could put together another Tin Machine episode. I mean, obviously we've got Tin Machine 2, there's the live albums, there's the BBC sessions. There's a number of ways we could do this, so I think it's well worth us looking into that. So stay tuned. In the meantime, I'd like to ask this question. What links Bovril, Andy Warhol, Edward Bulwer Lytton, Mickey Mouse, the Norfolk Broads, Generational Angst, Peter Noon, Ali Oop, and Aleister Crowley? That's right, it's Tin Machine 2. I am joking, of course. It's time now for Album to finally tackle that masterful, magisterial album from 1971 that arguably cemented Bowie's reputation, Hunky Dory. And really, who else could I invite back onto the podcast to debate it but your friend and mine, the Boswell of Bowie himself, Nick Pegg. Hunky Dory is a very easy album to love. I've yet to meet a Bowie fan who has anything other than the deep and profound fondness for it. And me, well, it goes without saying, I adore it. It's a mix, it's mad, it's kind of like a cuddly, dark, jaunty, twisted. It's rich with allusions, strong flavours, and esoteric themes. I mean, just look at it. It starts off with that colossal manifesto for the decade, Changes, in which our ancient mariner, there he is, fretting away at the ripe old age of 25, speaks of the bewilderment and confusion of a generation of pretty things who just squeezed past the 1960s and were now faced with picking up the pieces in the cold blue dawn of the 1970s. There's the protagonist of Life on Mars, walking through her sunken dreams to get a clear view. The proto-punk New York buzz of Queen Bitch, a camp, thrilling signpost of things to come. Or there's that lovely, bubbly celebration of Baby Zowie. Or there's the eerie, crepuscular meditations on spirituality, destiny, and existential angst in the forms of Quicksand or the Bewley Brothers. It's all here, and in this, the first of a two-part hunky-dory burger of an episode, we're going to try and make some sort of sense of it. So please, join me and Nick Pegg now as we sit back and address Hunky Dory. Enjoy!
Hello, Nick. Hi, welcome back to Album to Album.
Thank you very much for having me back.
And we're back. We're back. The dream team.
The dream team back again. It's a lovely summer day. And I saw you last night at the Terence Higgins Trust David Bowie auction.
What's the title? Well, it's the annual. Oh gosh, now I'm going to get it wrong. It's the David Bowie London fan event, I think is what it's called. But it's been going for 6 years now, organised by a whole load of fabulous people. But the prime movers are two wonderful ladies called Francesca and Elizabeth, and they do it in aid of the Terence Higgins Trust, which was a charity that was very close to David Bowie, and it's really fantastic. Over the last 5 years, you know, the first five of these events, they've raised more than £30,000 for the charity, which is incredible because it's only a small event. And last night, people were being incredibly generous. I don't know what the final figure is yet, at the time of recording, because it was only last night. But just the auction on its own, without factoring in the tickets and the raffle and all the other things that ways that people were donating, the auction of items came to about £3,500, which was extraordinary in a room full of only about 150 people. It was wonderful. And some wonderful acts were performing. People like David McAlmont, who was with his colleague Clifford Slapper, the chap who's done a wonderful acoustic album called Bowie Songs One, which is Clifford on piano. He's a wonderful pianist, and various guest vocalists, other people like Ray Burmiston, and
now you told me about Clifford's claim to fame, so to speak.
Bowie-wise. Well, yes, of course, Clifford's done all sorts of things. He's has worked as a session player and a band member with all sorts of people. But yeah, one of his claims to fame is that he was actually the chap who played the piano part for Bowie in the episode of Extras that he appeared, you know, when he sang that rude, you know, the insulting song that he improvised on the spot about Ricky Gervais's character.
Little fat man.
The little fat man with the pug-nosed face. Yeah. I'll tell you a fact about that song that seems to have sort of disappeared into the realms of time since David Bowie's sad death. That was actually the very last song that David Bowie performed on stage, because the last time that Bowie, you know, got up on stage in front of a big audience and sang in any way, shape or form was when he introduced Ricky Gervais onto the stage at the Highline Festival in New York, which Bowie curated. And to get Ricky Gervais on, he got the audience to do a big sing-along of The Little Fat Man with the Pug-Nosed Face. So, okay, that doesn't really count, of course. It wasn't like a proper gig with a band and everything. But that was the last thing that David Bowie sang on stage in front of an audience.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's great. Isn't that good?
A marvellous way to go out. Because I thought the last thing he did on stage was Life on Mars. Remember Fashion Rocks?
Yeah, that's right. The proper last thing that he did was about a year earlier when he did, I think it was it Fantastic Voyage? And, I ought to know this stuff. And Life on Mars.
Life
and
on Mars
Changes,
I've seen.
I think.
And of course, Life on Mars is leading in perfectly to what
we're actually here to talk about.
You have chosen to talk about Hunky Dory. And so, I suppose, obviously, the first question is, why? Hunky Dory?
Possibly because I'm bonkers, because how long have we got? Can this podcast be about 8 hours long, or...
Why don't we ask the listeners?
The thing about Hunky Dory... Well, look, you could say this about a lot of Bowie albums, of course. There isn't a single Bowie album that you can just grasp and fully understand, but Hunky Dory is certainly... That is an album that, at best, can only be sort of entered and explored, and you could
it's
do a whole
one,
series of podcasts just about Hunky Dory and get different people to come in and talk about, you know, because you can go on and on and on about Hunky Dory, and apologies in advance if I do, and we won't even scratch the surface. So yeah, there's no way that this or any other podcast or any book or anything can be
fully
the definitive, can do Hunky Dory, that we can explore bits of it and try to pull a few threads out and examine them, because there's so much there, isn't there? The story of the album, the songs, the way the themes, the everything. It's, of course, from a fascinating period in Bowie's career. 1971 was the year that everything changed for Bowie. It was the year that it all kind of came together for him, really, wasn't it? He'd already had a hit with Space Oddity in 69, but that was the only hit he'd had at that point. The next chart success of any sort that Bowie had was actually a cover version of one of his songs. It was Peter Noone's version of You Pretty Things.
Yeah.
Oh, You Pretty Things was, as far as we know, the first Hunky Dory song that Bowie composed. He wrote it as early as the beginning, sort of January 71, something like that, was when he demoed it. And it was rapidly farmed out by his manager and his publisher, Bob Grace, at Chrysalis Music, that Bowie had just signed up to Mickey Most,
the famous
producer, who was very sort of pop producer, who was very big at the time. And Mickey Most said, this is perfect for Peter Noone, who had just left Herman's Hermits at the time. And that became Peter Noone's debut solo single. And that came out, was recorded and came out before Hunky Dory was in the can, you know, before Bowie's own version that we're now so familiar with. And that went to number 12 in the summer of 1971. So that was
a reasonable hit.
Yeah. And if you look in, you can find photos of Bowie. They're probably online somewhere, but they're in books and things. There are photos of Bowie with his long 1971 hair standing proudly, grinning rather inanely, in front of a big billboard with "Oh, You Pretty Things" Peter Noone written on it. That's basically David Bowie doing a selfie going, look, I've got a hit.
Look at me.
Because he, as I said, that was his second successful thing of any sort. Mm. It was the second time he'd ever seen chart action. By the end of the year, of course, Hunky Dory was released and he was already halfway through making Ziggy Stardust and everything was happening.
You know, he was moving at warp speed, wasn't he, basically? I mean, imagine from January 1971, he didn't have a record contract at that point. And he was playing, then I think RCA heard a few demos from what was going to become Hunky Dory. And then they snapped him up, 3-record deal.
That's right.
And at the same time, here he was coming out of The Man Who Sold the World, which was a pretty dark, very Ronson-heavy album. By all accounts, Bowie's involvement with the music of The Man Who Sold the World was fairly minimal. But Hunky Dory is a beautiful, lush... It's a songwriter album.
That's right.
And now songwriter albums were very much in vogue in the early 70s. But here... The long-haired songwriter who was giving away tracks to people like Peter Noon was looking for a while like he's found, you know, he's found a direction.
Yes.
So this is how it could go. Before we delve too deeply into the history of the record, though, I'm very interested in your personal history with Hunky Dory. Do you remember when you first encountered this album and what kind of effect it had on you?
Gosh. Yeah, I do, actually. I came to Hunky Dory, well, first thing to say, I was too young at the time. I was 3 years old or something when it came out, 3 or 4 years old. So obviously I was too young in 1971. I didn't really discover Hunky Dory until I was a student in the mid-80s, actually. A friend of mine had it. In fact, lots of friends of mine had it. It was a real student album. Probably still is. But it certainly was in the mid-80s. And obviously I knew some of the famous ones. I knew Changes and Life on Mars and things. But yeah, first time I really heard, you know, well, all of those beautiful album tracks that aren't on all the greatest hits compilations, you know, things like Quicksand and, of course, the Bewley Brothers, that terrific song at the end. I guess I was 18, 19, something like that. And yeah, it did have a, you know, as profound an effect on me as it has had on so many people. It is just an extraordinary album because, of course, the other reason that I chose to talk about it is quite simply it's, you know, I don't do favourites, so I haven't got a favourite David Bowie album. But if I did have, it would probably be Hunky Dory. I'll change my mind in a minute.
If you did have favourites, it would be Hunky Dory.
Exactly,
Not Never Let Me Down.
Not Never Let Me Down, in spite of previous... I love them all, as you know. I know, and it was a delight to talk about Never Let Me Down and to speak up in its defence. But Hunky Dory is a masterpiece, and I wouldn't use that word.
You know that's our most popular episode to date.
Is it?
As you talk about
that's
Never
nice.
Let Me Down. Yes.
Very nice to know. Oh, good. Well, I hope... It was great to talk about that album because, you know, this is wonderful to talk about Hunky Dory. How fantastic. And there's lots to talk about, and we will. But to talk about Never Let Me Down, which is a thing that hardly ever gets talked about, apart from, you know, someone blowing a raspberry and moving on, I think it was good. It was good fun, wasn't it, that?
I mean, I certainly discovered a lot about it during the course of that podcast and afterwards that prompted at least a revisit. And while I don't think I could expound on it as enthusiastically as you did, I wouldn't blow it a raspberry and move on so quickly.
Excellent. I'm delighted to hear it. And if a few people heard that podcast and thought the same, then my work here is done.
So we're back in the 80s and the student Peg is
starving in a garret in the wilds, in the mean streets of Exeter. That's where I was a student. Yeah.
And there you discover Hunky Dory. And were you a Bowie fan at that point already?
I mean, it was around about the time that I was becoming... a Bowie fan. Actually, I'll tell you what, a friend of mine who had Hunky Dory and was well into the album already, I can date this exactly because the news came through. He was at Oxford because he was cleverer than me, obviously. I was visiting him in Oxford on, as it turned out, the day that Andy Warhol's death was announced.
Oh, February 87.
And so was that February 87? Yeah. And my friend Alec whipped out Hunky Dory and immediately put on... the song, of course, Andy Warhol, you know, and we sat there and listened to that. And I think that was the first time I'd ever heard that song. I think it was. So thanks, Alec.
Thanks, Andy, for conveniently dying, I guess.
So that was an interesting introduction to that song, I suppose, in a way that, you know, the first time I heard it was when it was being played as a sort of in memoriam of the death of Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol.
In a student room.
Looks a scream, hang him on my wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, which he wasn't that pleased about, was he?
Andy Warhol himself. Yeah. Well, apparently the legend goes, as David Bowie later told it, that he was because when Bowie went over to America in mid 71 to sign his contract with RCA in America, when things were sort of kicking off, He played you know, acetate or whatever it was of Andy Warhol to the great man when they were introduced at the factory. And yeah, by all accounts, Mr. Warhol was distinctly unimpressed. He thought it was a piss take rather than a tribute. homage, a tribute. Yeah. And apparently he sort of listened to it and then just got up and left the room without saying anything. And then came back in again.
But I mean, the most articulate of people.
He was, of course, famous for his sort of, his awkwardness was part of his shtick, wasn't it? But Bowie and Warhol remained, you know, they were sort of spotted together, and, you know, many times over the years after that. And Warhol used to come to Bowie's concerts when he came to New York, you know, and so on. So they kind of knew each other, and I don't think they were ever massively close, but they, you know, they kind of, they respected each other. Well, obviously Bowie respected him, but Warhol did, you know, had a great respect for Bowie's work, and, you know, said some nice things about him over the years. Yeah, but at the time, apparently he was, he wasn't exactly thrilled.
He liked his shoes, didn't he?
He liked Bowie. Apparently the meeting ended with Warhol whipping out his Polaroid and taking some photos of Bowie's shoes. And then he just said, "Goodbye, David, you have such beautiful shoes." And then just sort of left.
But I think Warhol had been hurt in the past, because he tried to befriend Dylan in the mid-60s and gave him a silver Elvis, you know, one of the large silver Elvises. And then over some sort of rivalry over Edie Sedgwick, Dylan started using silver Elvis as a dartboard, which made Andy incredibly paranoid and upset. So obviously then he was...
I hadn't heard that story. Yeah. That's interesting. Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Of course, that you bring up Dylan, because...
right.
Hey, it's almost like a link, isn't it? Dragging it back to... No, but this is germane, isn't it? Because part of the structure and, you know... what Bowie's doing on Hunky Dory is he devotes quite a bit of, effectively the second side of the album, to paying tribute to some of his American heroes and influences. Because we have, well, first of all, side two opens with a cover version. I think, is that the first cover version on a Bowie album? Yes, it is. Many years after that, he would do, you know, a cover version or two in tribute. So that's an interesting thing. Yeah. So a cover version of an American songwriter who he obviously admired and thought a lot of at the time, Biff Rose. That's Fill Your Heart. That's the only song that Bowie didn't write that's on the album. Then, of course, we have Andy Warhol, about Andy Warhol. Then we have Song for Bob Dylan. And then we have Queen Bitch, which, of course, is a sort of tribute, homage, compliment to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. And so there's a lot of Bowie's... he was besotted from an early age with America, but at this point, you know, this was the first album that he wrote after he'd been to America for the first time.
That's
and actually
remarkable.
Met people and come back, and he was you know, so there's a lot of Americana on the album, quite nakedly, but the great thing is, I think it's also quite clear, it's a very British album. You know, he hadn't in an odd sort of way, some of his earlier writing is more Americanized, some of his, even at the Decca days, you know, he's trying to be more American in some of it's very, but Hunky Dory is such a British sensibility, I think, but he's writing about these American things. It's an interesting sort of clash
certain perspective.
It's an odd sort of prism to get. I mean, there's a great little example right there in the lyrics of Andy Warhol, actually, because he's singing about this New York pop artist, but suddenly we get two new pence to have a go. Yeah. Topical reference to decimalisation, which happened in February 71.
During the recording of Hunky Dory.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, this is exactly what we're going to be talking about, but before we go too far down side two just yet...
Right, we've done side two before side one.
Let's go back a little bit and start with Where Was Our Man in 1971. So... going into Hunky Dory, what was going on in his life?
Well, it was an interesting period, and it was quite a difficult period for him, really. He had recorded The Man Who Sold the World in early to mid 1970, and as you mentioned earlier on, that had, you know, it resulted in a very good album, but by all accounts, including Bowie's own, his commitment to that album was a bit a bit up in the air and all over the place. Partly because he was very busy courting and getting married to his first wife, Angie, and partly because, you know, he was just sort of, you know, being a bit of a hippie and sitting around a bit. And Tony Visconti, who produced that album, you know, has told stories about how he really had to sort of drag David into the studio to write some lyrics and get some, you know...
Because you're hanging out in the reception with Angie, wasn't it?
That's, well, apparently so, yeah. So the result, it's a great album, and it is a David Bowie album. I don't really have any time for this idea that he didn't write those songs and that Tony Visconti and Mick Ronson wrote them. That's clearly not true, but it is true, and you can hear it on the album, that Mick Ronson and Tony Visconti are doing a lot of the heavy lifting, and it ends up sounding like a sort of a... It's a different sort of a rock album, but, you know... And so he turns this right around with Hunky Dory the following year. And what had happened in between was that, well, for one thing, Tony Visconti had moved on and gone off to work with Mark Bolan. Yeah. Well, he'd already been working with Mark Bolan, but he, basically, Tony Visconti had sort of had enough of that Haddon Hall commune was a little bit disenchanted with Bowie's attitude during the making of The Man Who Sold the World. So he went off to concentrate on working with Bolan and wasn't on the Bowie scene for the next 2 or 3 years.
Only coming back
to mix Diamond Dogs, or to, you know, during the mixing stage. And from then on, of course, went on to famously become Bowie's long-running producer for many, many years. So that had happened. And as you also mentioned earlier, the Bowie's recording contract, he just got a new manager, Tony DeVries. His recording contract was up for renewal with Mercury Records, but his hotshot new manager didn't want any of that. He wanted to get Bowie a better contract. So he disentangled Bowie from Mercury and signed him up with RCA instead, which is sort of, the label of Elvis Presley. You know, it's a much more sort of, you know...
And he was an incredibly, how do we say, dynamic character.
Yes,
DeVries.
I mean, he was.
He was going to turn his boy into a star. He had that New York swag.
That's right. Yeah, he clearly, you know, I don't know if he modelled himself on Colonel Tom Parker, but he certainly, there was that aspect. He loved the stories about, Elvis's famous, notorious manager, Colonel Tom Parker, and the way he would, you know, sort of, he could... you know, sell anything to anybody and you know, as ruthlessly as you like. He clearly, as we know, the story did not end happily with Tony DeVries, and it was a right mess. But at the same time, there's no questioning the fact that his sort of hard-boiled huckster way of doing things did actually help to push Bowie up there at that point. So, he was a very interesting figure.
We also have Angie.
We also have Angie, who was helping to...
Input. Time.
That's right. We also have the fascinating introduction to the Bowie circle of the cast of this play Pork, which was a sort of succès de scandale in London in the summer of 1971, just at the time that the Hunky Dory sessions were going on. Bowie met all these freaky people from New York who he was quite taken by, partly, of course, because they all knew Warhol. This was a play that was based on Warhol's recordings of people from the sort of...
The factory and
the general sort of demi-monde of New York sort of craziness. And it was we were only, 3 years out of the Lord Chamberlain's, restrictions on theatre. Yeah. So in the London theatre scene in 1971, this was a sort of great big... It was a sort of explosion of bad taste. And all the reviews, obligingly said it makes, hair look like a vicar's tea party and all those sort of things. So of course everyone flocked to see it. It was at the Roundhouse, and Bowie went to see it. And so there were all these crazy people doing all these crazy Warhol things, and he thought they were great. And he got to know them. They all came to see Bowie do a little gig in the summer of 71. It was, again, during the Hunky Dory sessions or just after. And, it was just Bowie with his long hair and his floppy hat and his guitar doing, Kooks and Life on Mars or whatever, those sort of songs, changes. And they all sat in the audience and attracted his attention, shall we say.
But you can imagine like a little gig somewhere, maybe in a pub in Beckenham or something like that, then suddenly the cast of a Warhol play walk in.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And more than a few beer mugs would be dropped on the floor, you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. Now, I do think that the importance of these people has in some respects been exaggerated by some people, because Bowie was very insistent that, his, as far as he was concerned, his map was already drawn. He knew what he was doing. But certainly the arrival of these freaky people and, sort of adding them to his sort of coterie was not insignificant, particularly when once the whole Bowie operation, particularly when it moved to America the following year and everything, it was basically the cast of Pork, people like Cherry Vanilla and Tony Zanetta, that were hired by Tony DeFries, the manager, to you know, spread the word. And they become part of the management structure of Main Man, this company that Tony DeFries had set up to manage Bowie.
Who was his PA before Coco? Was it Lee Black Childers? One of the team.
That
was in this ridiculous position of being his PA.
That's right.
By dint of their freakishness and craziness, they were sort of subsumed into the company.
That's right. But going back to your original question about where Bowie was in 71 and how it had moved on from The Man Who Sold the World. The other thing, and in a sense, I think actually the most important thing, so this whole, all this career stuff and management stuff is, of course, important because that helped to get the word out there. But the most important thing, of course, was the songs and the music and the work.
Yeah.
And what had changed there was, as I did mention a while ago, Bowie had got a new publishing contract with Chrysalis, which was at that stage quite a new company. And they loved Bowie's work. I think it was on the basis of Holy Holy, actually, the original single version of that song, which is funny, isn't it? Because it's a perfectly good song, but it's not exactly the most sort of striking. But that was the one that reeled them in.
It's good.
But on the basis of that and a couple of other tracks, Chrysalis signing up, and it was actually a really rather fabulous deal for someone who, at that point, was a fairly unproven one-hit wonder from a few years ago. So he had a new publishing deal, and Bob Gross, this chap at Chrysalis, was a real champion of this young songwriter. And gave him plenty of, you know, gave him studio time at Radio Luxembourg Studios, you know, booked him in there, and he started writing and demoing songs. So, as you said earlier on, the one of the key things about Hunky Dory is that, unlike The Man Who Sold the World, it's an album that was written and demoed, and, you know, the material was honed and worked on for, in some cases, for months before he recorded it. So what you end up with, as you said, is a sort of a, you know, is much more of a singer-songwriter album. For one thing, you just have to look at the lyric sheet. It's a very wordy album. Mm. The songs have got lots and lots and lots of lyrics. You know, look at The Man Who Sold the World.
Very dense.
The lyrics are fantastic, but, you know, something like Black Country Rock has got
eight lines. Like a haiku,
yeah.
It is an eight-line poem.
Yeah, it is. Very good. But so that's interesting, isn't it? The other change that had happened just in terms of his process was that Bowie was starting, more than he ever had done before, to play the piano. And this is significant. He wasn't the world's most proficient pianist, but he was good enough to bash out a few things. And the fact that he was writing songs on the piano now rather than on the guitar changes the nature of the type of songs he was writing. So if you think about a song like Changes or a song like Life on Mars, you can sort of tell that he wrote it on the piano. Mm. Of course, that's not him playing the piano on Life on Mars. No. As we know, it's Rick Wakeman in the final product, because he was a better pianist than most pianists who walk the face of the earth, but certainly more proficient than Bowie. And Bowie knew his limitations. But Bowie does play piano on the album. That's him on Oh You Pretty Things. You know, he really? doing the sort of boom 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 boom. Dun, yeah, yeah. Dun, dun. And you know, on some of the tracks he plays it himself. But yes, the really flowery, wonderful stuff he entrusted quite rightly to.
He lucked out with his pianists, didn't he? Garson, Wakeman. I mean, Bowie's had some wonderful, fantastic pianists.
I think it was always an important part of the band for him. You know, some rock and rollers sort of, you know, keyboards is just like a little extra guy in the back who fills in a bit. But for Bowie, it was a really important part of the sound. It is actually fascinating, isn't it, about, I mean, Rick Wakeman, his piano is I think almost, you could almost describe it as the defining feature of Hunky Dory. It's the thing that sets Hunky Dory apart. Mm. Among Bowie albums,
it's
the
definitely
sound
a
of that.
Sound.
And an interesting little side story, digressing again, because this is what happened after Hunky Dory, is that when the sessions for the next album began, which almost immediately, Bowie popped off to America to sign his contract, came back.
Pretty much came back as Ziggy.
Exactly. Yeah. Came back and said, right, I've got another album ready, and started recording Ziggy. So it was, you know, we're still talking about the sort of late summer of 71 here, into the autumn. And Bowie did ask Rick Wakeman to come back again and play, and subsequently asked him, you know, or at the same time asked him if he'd like to join the band and tour with them and all of this stuff. As it just so happened, Rick Wakeman had apparently in the space of the same 24 or 48 hours had just been invited to join Yes as well.
Okay.
So for Wakeman, he loved Bowie's songs, he loved the music, he loved playing on Hunky Dory, but it was a choice between, you know, carrying on as David Bowie's piano player or having a sort of more creative input into a band. And that's why he went for Yes. It's interesting, though, isn't it, to speculate. Would Ziggy Stardust have been a better album with Rick Wakeman playing the piano? He's brilliant, but what happened on Ziggy Stardust is that Mick Ronson instead stepped in to play the piano. And Mick Ronson was a very good pianist, but he was a far less ornate pianist.
He's a rock and roll
pianist. He's a rock and roll pianist. And he plays on Transformer as well, yeah. Like, yeah, for Lou Reed and so on. And I think that Mick Ronson's much less adorned style really suits the Ziggy Stardust album. Imagining something like Lady Stardust with Rick Wakeman's yeah. sort of baroque frills all over it, fantastic though they are, would that have been right? I'm not sure it would, but it's fascinating to speculate how things might have been if Rick Wakeman had said yes. Would Ziggy Stardust have been more of a hunky-dory sounding album? It's really interesting, isn't it?
I think it would have... No, I mean, he came back from America with a pocket load of songs, which, I mean, you see, like you mentioned earlier, Queen Bitch signaled the way that they were going. And, you know, a far more punky, sharp, new... I mean, that Queen Bitch is New York, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. New York.
But, I mean, Rick Wakeman, to me, is very English.
Yes.
And his style of playing is, like, it's a very baroque and yes. fit. And the prevailing trend at that time for bands like Yes, you know, big, overblown productions. I think Wakeman made the right choice. I don't think his talents would have been well served by the... especially the warped speed of Bowie's evolution.
Yeah.
That was great at that moment, but then going forward to Ziggy, Aladdin, Sane,
absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Wakeman's style would have...
Yeah. Well, as I say, it wasn't because he didn't want to play for Bowie, it's just that out of those two, you know, he had to choose between them, and for his point of view, obviously the Yes offer was slightly more attractive because it meant he could sort of write songs and be involved in the thing rather than just sort of be the side man.
What was he doing before Bowie? He wasn't high profile, was he?
Not really. He'd been a session player. One of his very first sessions was actually with Bowie. He played on Space Odyssey. Good heavens. Can we cut that, please? I'll have to give my membership card back. That's terrible. Yeah.
Space
he played on Space Oddity and a few other early Bowie recordings. The 1970 version of London by Tartar has got Rick Wakeman on piano as well. And of course, he came back later to play for Bowie. He played on Absolute Beginners, and you know, with great distinction. But yeah, he'd worked with the Straubs, hadn't he, and a few other little bits and bobs. But really, Hunky Dory, I guess, was his first really big exposure. His first sort of wow, who's this guy right. moment. I think I'm right in saying
Yeah, I read somewhere that he was doing sessions. He was just a jobbing musician, basically. But yeah, like you say, this was what a fantastic platform. So we have this wonderful, incredibly ornate and lyrical player
yeah.
coming together. Now, we start off with one of the biggest songs of Bowie's career, Changes.
Yeah.
There's so, as you said at the top of the podcast, there's so much we can unpack here. There's so much we can go into.
Goodness me, yes.
Can you just briefly... summarize for me what is going on in Changes. What are the themes? What are the inspirations here?
Okay, well, it Changes is this song on its own is a song we could do a whole podcast about. Gosh, I think it's actually a sometimes slightly misunderstood song because understandably it's been leapt on over the years as a sort of there's David Bowie's musical manifesto. Changes, yeah. Hooray! Yes, he always changes, doesn't he? Changes his hair color, changes his clothes. It's about altogether deeper things than that. It introduces a theme that runs right through Hunky Dory, which is the whole album is steeped with this sort of dread of oblivion and impermanence and I don't know, dread, a sort of anxiety about it, you know? And of course it's about Bowie's own creative muse and about his career, quite frankly, you know. Every time I thought I'd got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. A million dead end streets, all this sort of, you know, this could just be a songwriter saying, "Good God, I've tried, I haven't had a hit."
And
he turns it around, and by the time we get to the end of the chorus, he's going, you know, he's basically, you know, quite almost quite arrogantly sort of saying, you know, I'm going to move so fast that you won't even be able to, you know. Trace time, that sort of thing. But the other thing about it, of course, is that it references some of the flagship pop songs of the 1960s, of Bowie's teenage years. You know, the changes can't help but remind you of my generation with its stuttering, you know, people try to all that stuff. And of course, Hope I Die Before I Get Old. Yep. Pretty soon now you're going to get older. There it is again, you know. So, you know, these things cannot be a mistake. You know, this is so he's
very deliberate, isn't it? This is something that was on his mind because I think he wrote All the Young Dudes around the same time. Was that maybe or a little bit earlier?
All the Young Dudes a little bit later. Yeah,
A lot of the themes there again, you know, are perhaps a bit more explicitly alluded to.
Yes.
In All the Young Dudes, but Changes is very much a generation and yes. then the individual, so like, you know, the micro and the macro.
Yes. That way. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely that. And as I say, if you kind of think about some of the other songs on the album that also sort of bristle with this angst about his own creativity and his own the songs like Quicksand and all of them. just all of them. So he kind of opens the album with this song that's about. He said this album is about my changes and those of some of my friends. That was he said that in 1971, which is a nice little quote that just, typically difficult to grasp. What do you mean by that? But it's great,
it's
isn't it?
It's tantalizingly close because obviously he didn't know at the time that he'd go on to craft so many successful personas that he would become this, the chameleon of pop.
Yeah.
The iconic
comedian.
Here he was giving, going on what you've just said. Here he is being very honest in one way, very soul bearing.
Yeah, yeah.
With his audience, like a million dead end streets, and this hasn't worked out. So I've turned to look inside myself, and now yes, here we go.
Yes.
Which, am I right?
Yeah, I know. I think you're right. I mean, because.
You're looking very doubtful.
No. I was just thinking, which, if you hear machinery grinding, that was the sound of me thinking.
When you said that, it just kind of clicked into place with me. Yeah, you've always said, never leap with Bowie. You can never just leap to one assumption. Obviously, there's a lot more going on.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Certainly in this case, I think that, yes, absolutely spot on.
It's, Hunky Dory, one might say, is not the very last, of course, but certainly... The end of his first phase of albums, which there's something quite personal and confessional, if you like, about the Space Oddity album and The Man Who Sold the World and Hunky Dory in Places. By the time you get to Ziggy Stardust, it's become a bit more detached, a bit more ironic,
right,
a bit more.
Exactly, yeah.
So this is almost he I'm not saying he never wrote about himself again, but Hunky Dory is, as you say, much more sort of soul bearing, chest bearing, whatever. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, another 1960s. Song that Bowie would have been, of course, very familiar with was "The Times They Are a Changing" by Bob Dylan. So again, time may change me. He's riffing on these influential, important, familiar songs, but he's forging his own. So maybe it is like a manifesto in that respect. It's like, here's my generation. Here's my times they are changing, and this is what I'm opening my album with.
Just as an aside, I'm sorry, but I remember when we discussed Space Oddity, you brought up again the prevalence of time.
Yes,
as being such a continuous theme in the songs, and again here it's what he seems to have sort of been picking from these songs that he references. Even Times Are Changing, My Generation, Time May Change Me, and again it's something that is almost an all-encompassing, preoccupation of his. Such a big deal that this young man.
It's absolutely one of his key themes through his career. And yes, it's you're right, because you'd maybe expect it of an older person to getting preoccupied by this thing. But no, right from the beginning, Bowie was writing about mortality and time and the march of time and the relentlessness of time and the cruelty of time. The dispassionate I don't give a shit of time. It's fascinating. It's clearly something that exercised his mind a great deal and it informs so many of his songs. And this is a thing that, again, we find all the way through Hunky Dory. It's very, very explicit on changes. But it's, I think it's there right through the album, this sort of almost fear that my time is up. Have I blown it already? That the creative well might be running dry, that, I'm sinking in the quicksand of my thought and I ain't got the power anymore. That's extraordinary stuff for a 25-year-old to be, 24-year-old to be writing.
But at the same time, it's ironic in exploring this, he comes up with some of the greatest art that he's created hitherto in his career.
Right.
Well, moving on.
Moving on.
into this funny little song, which is it was the hit for Peter.
Yes.
Peter Noon. I always have this story about Peter Noon being at the airport and he's paging Mr. No One. But yeah, OU Pretty Things, which is, it's full of very opaque imagery, and it kind of reminds me a little of Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed, which we also talked about. Mm-hmm. Just some of the visual, you know, the succession of images that come and go.
Yes, it's a OU Pretty Things, apart from just being one of the most brilliantly catchy songs he had written up to that point. I mean, it's just very an instant.
That chorus,
You only have to listen to it once and you've got it. It's just a brilliant. It's also, it's sort of got one foot in the Bowie's previous songwriting and one in the future, as it were. It's got that sort of apocalyptic, eschatological sci-fi of The Man Who Sold the World a little bit, hasn't it? You know, the album generally. I mean, it's got it's a bit. Got a bit of Nietzsche going on.
The master
we've got
race.
Superman, we've got cracks in the sky and hands coming down and you know, disturbing stuff like that. But we've also got this sort of stomping piano and hand claps and glam is beginning to appear, you know, in Bowie's songwriting, musically.
It is just, this is a good point to mention, it is a very upbeat, bouncy album.
Yeah.
Apart from a couple of standout tracks, obviously, but it has got this jauntiness to it.
Yeah. I think it's really subversive because, you know, David Bowie never wrote a happy album, let's face it. He did once say many years later that he didn't understand how, he didn't like happy albums, he didn't own one and he would never want to make one. And Hunky Dory, if you, you know, once you listen to the words, it's as bleak as they come. But you're quite right. It's very...
It's very jaunty.
Radio-friendly, playlist-friendly, and, it, you know, you can sort of bop along to it. But yes, once you start listening to the words of Oh, You Pretty Things, or any number of the other songs, you go, oh my goodness.
Words are quite extraordinary. Like you said, you know, it's a very sci-fi kind of black themes.
I mean, it's clearly, you know, it's as at his best as ever, Bowie is, you know, his roots are showing, as it were, and there's bits of this. Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke is obviously a book he'd read, because this is about a sort of, you know, the race of children who develop sort of strange powers
and
their parents. There's a reference in it, of course, to the coming, they're part of The Coming Race. That's a book. The Coming Race was an 1871 bestseller by Edward Bulwer Lytton, who is a writer that nobody really reads anymore. But in his day, he outsold Charles Dickens. He was one of the most famous...
sci-fi writer.
Well, he was a novelist and playwright and wrote... very prolific. Among his many... You know, he wrote some potboilers and historical things and some sci-fi. But yeah, The Coming Race was a sci-fi novel. He was so successful that, you know, he advised Dickens on the ending of Great Expectations. Really? Dickens, you know... used to occasionally send him his manuscripts, and I believe, and say, you know, what do you think of this? It was Edward Bulwer Lytton who convinced Charles Dickens to make the very ending of Great Expectations a little bit more upbeat than Dickens was planning to do it. He was hugely, hugely popular in his day. His fame has not really lasted, but how very like Bowie to pick up this. So, The Coming Race, 1871, as I say, is about a race of super beings who live under the earth, and they are... They have a sort of mystical power called the Vril. I bring this up because here's another fascinating did you know. When the makers of a new beef drink wanted a name for their thing, so they got
Bov.
Bovine Bov, and Vril was so famous because this book was such a massive smash hit. It was like people knowing about Harry Potter or The Force from Star Wars. Everybody
this is where
had heard
Bovril comes
the
from.
Name Bovril. Comes from The Coming Race by Edward Bulwer Lytton, totally forgotten book that was one of the biggest bestsellers of the late 19th century.
Yeah. That's what a big deal this guy was.
Yeah, and so anyway, Bowie pops in a reference in Oh, You Pretty Things to that, isn't that? So there we go. Don't tell me you're not learning anything. It's a song about how the next generation of children are evolving away from their parents and being a little bit scary. So that's
a little bit scary.
Yeah. But you know, you just listen to it superficially and it's You Pretty Things, and it sounds like a great dance along.
That's why Mickey Most picked it up for Peter Noon.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and interestingly, when Mickey Most's version that was done, you know, that he recorded for Peter Noon, on which Bowie did play piano, by the way, they interestingly begin with the chorus. It opens with Oh, You Pretty Things, and then it goes back to do the first verse. So they go straight in with the sort of catchy bit. You know, it's very pop chart friendly. They also change the word bitch to beast. The earth is a beast, just to sort of, you know, not offend anyone.
Yes.
It is quite extraordinary, actually. So this upbeat poppy song, which is actually about this kind of, you know, Nietzschean, crazy, super scary children.
Talking about hands in the sky.
Talking about the Homo Superior. Yeah, it's exactly. Heavy stuff.
So we're two songs in, and already we've dealt with, my God, we've dealt with science fiction, we've dealt with the coming of a future master race.
We've had children twice over, of course, haven't we? Because, you know, these children that you spit on in Changes, you know, so there's a lot of sort of my generation and maybe even the generation of people younger than me. I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about David Bowie. You know, he's kind of, it's a sort of, you know, move over, granddad.
Right.
The new breed has arrived. There's a feeling of that to the whole album, isn't there?
Well, of course, in his personal life at this point, children were very much at the forefront of his mind.
Very much so,
But then we just have this little interlude now of eight-line poem.
Eight-line poem,
I think is one of my favourite moments on any Bowie album. I mean, it's just such a gorgeous little, and you said that was him playing piano on this.
Yes, this is again Bowie on piano on that one. Yes, he's on Oh You Pretty Things and on 30. He plays on Changes as well. Eight Line Poem is that the most overlooked track on Hunky Dory, do you think? It is this funny little interlude almost between. Yeah. It's almost like a footnote to Oh You Pretty Things or a prelude to the biggie that's coming straight after. But it's a great little moment. It's such a quiet, and Mick Ronson plays this almost sort of country and western twanging guitar.
Just those slow, lazy licks. Twisting around.
And it's this impressionistic little, it's just a little sort of moment in time of is Clara, I've always thought it's a cat, but because I put that in my book, I said, Clara puts her head between apples, and I said, it's a cat that's made a mobile fall to the floor, and someone had said to me a while ago, what makes you think it's a cat? I always thought it was a dog, but there you go, you see. This is, there's Bowie to a T. We can interpret it in any way we like.
Could have been a tiger, a cheetah, a panther, an okapi.
No, they don't have paws. But I think it's a cat. I wouldn't call a dog Clara. I'd call a cat Clara. I think, I don't know. But you see, that's just me.
Why not?
I don't know really.
What was his dog called? Max.
I don't know. We had lots of dogs over here. Did he have a dog called Max? Yes.
When he died, he had a dog called Max with different coloured eyes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's you see pap shops every now and again. Viman walking around New York, walking Max. It's overlooked, it's a little, you know, it's like Don't Sit Down or something, you know, in that tradition. Yeah. But it, like you said, it does have this wonderful sort of fusing of Oh You Pretty Things to the big, you know, the second big epic track of the album, which I'm just seeing here, was actually voted Pitchfork called it the best song of the 1970s.
Yes.
I guess we have a lot to talk about. Nick, how do you summarise for, I don't think there's a single person listening to this who hasn't heard Life on Mars, but if there is someone listening to this podcast right now who hasn't heard Life on Mars, in a nutshell, what is this song?
You don't ask for much, do you?
You're going to learn it.
Well, of course, it's an amazing piece of melodic and harmonic songwriting. It's a song about a young girl who is disappointed in her life, and she walks out on her parents and goes to the cinema and, for a brief moment, for however long the film is, escapes from the disappointment and dullness of her sort of grey life by living a vicarious fantasy life through the cinema. And that's what it's about, really. And out of that, rather sort of, it's almost like a kitchen sink plot if you describe it like that, but Bowie creates this great explosion of colour and beauty and possibility. It's at the same time a deeply sad song, I think, and also a sort of revelatory, optimistic, sort of encouraging song, you know, that there are possibilities out there. It introduces, of course, another key motif of the Hunky Dory album, which is films and the silver screen. Later on, the silver screen comes up again, of course, in Andy Warhol. And in Quicksand, we'll have I'm Living in a Silent Film. Well, this girl is sort of living in films as well. Life on Mars is a great example of something that befalls David Bowie's songs a lot, I think, which you did touch upon earlier on, and which is this idea, which I think really has to be knocked on the head, that Bowie's songs are somehow some sort of cryptic crossword puzzle, and that there's a solution. There's a single meaning, and once you've cracked it, you know what the song's about. That is not the case. It's not only that it is not the case; it is actively the opposite of what Bowie's songs are like. You know, he was a true modernist in the style of, you know, someone like T.S. Eliot or something like that. In what he wrote, he actively encouraged people to bring their own interpretations to things, or to bring that, you know, whatever the song happens to mean to you. Yeah. that's okay. And actually, that is what the song means for you. And it might mean something totally different for me. So we don't have to worry about, you know, of course I've sat there and thought, I wonder what actual film it is with the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Was he thinking about a specific film? That would be fascinating to know. And of course that's just silly fan speculation. But of course that doesn't actually matter. And the exact images don't matter. The very point of them is their proliferation. This sort of, it's almost like a magician pulling flowers out from pocket. And of course the other thing about it, which I'm sure a lot of people know, is that some of the lines are actually little pull-ins from other sources. You know, "Look at those cavemen go" is a line lifted lock, stock and barrel from a song called Alley Oop that was a big hit for the Hollywood Argyles in the 60s, beginning of the 60s. It was a kind of joke number.
Again, referencing these very esoteric range of songs and things.
That's right.
Flavour and spice the
That's
stew.
Right. Yeah. Alley Oop was a syndicated newspaper cartoon about a caveman living in modern... This is a bit like Fred Flintstone, that sort of thing, you know. But "Look at those cavemen go," when Bowie takes it and puts it in that song, you can't help but think, as we know, he was hugely affected and influenced and taken by Stanley Kubrick's 2001. Right, yeah. So once David Bowie uses that line in a song, which he ends with a great big Also Sprach Zarathustra drum roll at the end, you know, the tip boom, 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 that makes you think as well, how can we not think of those cavemen at the beginning of 2001 when he sings "Look at Those Cavemen Go"?
Yeah, I thought that was a complete a direct
exactly.
reference.
And you see, that's David Bowie down to a T. Yes, he's just borrowed that line from a silly song about a caveman, but by putting it in the right place at the right time in a different context, can mean so many other things as well. And that's the absolute, you know, that's the definition of David Bowie's working method. You know, that it's a bricolage. As I said, it's modernism. That's what it is. You know, it's like The Wasteland or something like that. In fact, William Burroughs did compare some of the songs on Hunky Dory to T.S. Eliot.
You can see why. I mean, The Wasteland is an immediate comparison to something like Life on Mars. Mm. I mean, in its density, in its illusory properties. But there's something about this song that really seems to have just worked its way into the public's consciousness.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I mean, like you say, when you summarize it as you have, you know, a girl goes to the cinema, sees a film, and, you know, it's a disappointment, and then out of this unfolds so much.
Yeah.
But why this song? Why did it all come together?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think it's got to be partly just that it's such a very beautiful melody and chord, and it's so, you know, and Bowie sings it with such passion, and when that chorus comes in and he sails off with the sailors fighting in the dance hall. There's another one. David Bowie, in his first ever film, he was an extra in The Virgin Soldiers. Mm-hmm. You know, the film. He wasn't a sailor; he was a soldier, but he was sort of a soldier fighting in the dance hall in the scene that there's a punch up in the
Something
bar,
and he's
Now, look, that's just me thinking of another one, isn't it? It almost certainly didn't even go through Bowie's head, but there's a resonance. We're allowed to have these resonances, you know. I mean, going back to T.S. Eliot yet again, you know, he was one of the people who talked about the intentional fallacy, it was known as, when the literary critics first started writing about it. The idea that what the author intended is, that's neither the most important nor even, maybe even not even a valid way of looking at things. We're allowed, it's okay for it to mean whatever we want it to. I've completely lost my thread now. No. Why did Life on Mars begin? Well, another interesting thing, isn't it, is that it didn't happen immediately. Life on Mars is a great song, and people who heard Hunky Dory at the time no doubt loved it. Hunky Dory, of course, wasn't actually a hit until after Ziggy Stardust came out. Ziggy Stardust...
Really?
Hunky Dory was released at the end of 71. Ziggy Stardust, the album, was released in the summer of 72, so only about 6 months later, or a little bit more. And it was only in the wake of Ziggy Stardust's success that Hunky Dory, you know, people discovered it and bought it. And actually, in the end, it went higher than Ziggy. It went a couple of places higher in the charts than Ziggy Stardust by the end of 72. And Life on Mars was released as a single in 1973, so 2 years after it was recorded, it was released as a single, by which time Bowie was not the long-haired Hunky Dory Bowie.
He was
Ziggy. Yeah, he was right near the end of the famous tour, you know, the video.
That very famous video about Mick Rock where he's bleached out and he's got like the carrot top in full effect.
That's right. And that video was filmed only I'd have to go and check, but it was like something like only 3 or 4 weeks before the final Ziggy concert, the famous.
Really?
So it was right near the end of that. And that's when the song became a hit. You know, that's when Life on Mars was really kind of discovered by most people. So I guess in the context, unless you were already a dyed-in-the-wool Bowie fan in 1971,
you wouldn't have heard it.
You might have thought it was a new song. You might have known it was like Ziggy's latest one, you know.
Oh, it's our latest one from Ziggy, Life on Mars, Ziggy, space, outer
absolutely.
Space.
And as well, you know, live as well, it's an interesting thing that, you know, he sang it live a few times on the Ziggy tour, but only as part of a medley with some other songs. And after that, he didn't do it again until, I think, 76 on the Station to Station tour. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really, it wasn't until, I suppose, the Sirius Moonlight tour in 83 that it started to take flight as one of his acknowledged classics. That, right. You know, when that one came on, everyone, oh, it's Life on Mars, you know. And by the time you got to the Sound and Vision tour in 1990, I remember going to an early concert on that tour, at Birmingham NEC. I don't know if you've been to a Birmingham NEC. Not the
I
most.
The very, very first gig I ever went to was Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, right, yeah.
On their Introspective tour. And that was the Birmingham
And that was
NEC.
It, yeah. Not the most atmospheric of venues, it has to be said. And on that particular night, I do remember that the crowd was a little bit sort of unresponsive until a few songs in, we got to Life on Mars.
He dropped the big one.
And it was like a bomb drop. By the end of that song, the whole place was in a, you know, there was a huge cheer at the end, and Bowie sort of leaned into the microphone and said, "That's better, you're warming up," or something like that. You know, and by then, you know, and for the rest of his career, you know, it became one of his absolute, one of his sort of standards, one of his classics. And then, of course, you know, when he died, Life on Mars was, I think, the song more than any other, more maybe even than Heroes or something, that became the song that people were recording and doing as a tribute. You know, Lord famously sang it very beautifully at the Brit Awards. An organ scholar at St Albans Cathedral played it on the organ the day after Bowie died, and the footage went viral, and it was very beautiful, actually. And, you know, so Life on Mars ended up becoming, it's one of his sort of standards, isn't it? And it's been covered by so many people as well,
with
varying degrees of success. Yeah.
Which is remarkable when you think about the surrealism of the lyric.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder how many people who've, you know, I don't wish to be cast nasturtiums on anyone, but I wonder how many people have recorded Life on Mars and had absolutely no idea what they're singing about, really, because it is, you know, unless you sit down and have a think, it's just strange.
It's
words,
very strange,
isn't it?
the most unlikely, when I was preparing for this podcast, the most unlikely cover I found of it was Frida from ABBA.
Oh, yeah.
I think she changed the title slightly.
Well, it's a Swedish language version, isn't
exactly,
it? Yeah, from that's quite early on as well. That's from her solo album in about 75, I think.
That was an interesting
choice. It's a rather lovely version, isn't it?
It's not bad at all. And I mean, I love her voice anyway, but I mean, it's a really... I wonder what he made of that. I mean, was it Lulu? Did Lulu do it? I mean, she did quite a lot around that
think
time.
It's so. Lulu. Did Lulu do it? She certainly didn't do it with Bowie. She did a couple of other ones with him. But no, I don't know if she ever did it. I've famously or notoriously, or however you care to say it, Barbara Streisand covered it in the mid-70s in a version which... did not find favour with the great man. He was distinctly unimpressed by it. I think bloody awful was what he said when someone asked him what he thought of it. But
even the camp value of Barbara Streisand doing this wonderful big.
No, absolutely. Well, I don't think it particularly. I mean, no. Look, Barbara Streisand was a great artist on so many levels, but she wasn't maybe going through her prime period at that point, was she? I don't know. But no. I find it a bit grisly that the Barbara Streisand
cover
of Life on Mars.
Yeah.
Oh golly, now you're asking. Wow. There was a version a few years ago by a guy called Jasper Stievelink, I think, which was very good. It was quite a big hit on the continent, I think Belgium or something. Yeah.
Right.
That's a really lovely version. I think it's a song that's very easy to, you know, it can just go a bit sort of cruise ship, can't it? Life on Mars. Do you know what I mean? It can go a bit songs from the shows if it's not done sort of.
Even you hear these bizarre lyrics. But just about the music, was this the song that there's a Frank Sinatra connection here? Isn't there?
That's right. Winding the clock back to 1968, before Space Oddity, before any success at all, among the things that Bowie did was occasionally he would get pushed his way by his manager or his publisher some foreign lyrics, you know, some French lyrics or some Italian lyrics or something for a song. He wouldn't even be given the lyrics, actually. He'd just be given the song and he'd be asked to write some English lyrics for it. This was quite a common thing that happened at the time. And quite often these so-called translations weren't translations at all. It was just listening to the song and making up something else that goes with it, you know. Which indeed happened in reverse to Bowie when the I don't know if you've ever heard the Italian version of Space Oddity.
That was recorded in Solar.
Yeah, which means Lonely Boy, Lonely Girl. It's got nothing to do with space. It's just a sort of love song about a boy and a girl with the same... So Bowie used to do this thing, and you know, he wrote a few of these things. And one of the songs that came his way was this number called Comme d'habitude, which was written in French, as you will no doubt have already guessed.
I was thinking that was Swahili.
Anyway, so yeah, Bowie had a go at writing some English lyrics to that, and he called it Even a Fool Learns to Love. Mm. And there are some demos that he did that exist, which is that it's just really him singing it over the top of the original recording, so you can hear the sort of French vocal underneath, but Bowie's on top of it, yeah. He's giving it his all in these demos. You can really kind of tell that he wanted the gig, you know, writing the lyrics and hopefully maybe recording it as well. But in the end, the song's publisher decided against and went with someone else. And the someone else was Paul Anka, and the song became My Way. Mm-hmm. And of course, Frank Sinatra recorded it and had a certain degree of success with it. So when you look at the back cover of Hunky Dory, it says Life on Mars, and it says Inspired by Frankie. That's what that's all about, is Life on Mars began musically as Bowie's attempt to write a song around the same sort of chord structure as My Way. Not really as a, I don't think it was an act of revenge or, you know, sort of pissed offness or anything like that, but it was just a kind of wry look back at one of his own little failures from the past. Right. So again, you know, A Million Dead End Streets and Every Time I Thought I Got It Made.
And that was one of them.
Yeah.
That was one of the little Million Dead End Streets.
Absolutely.
Where they nearly thought he got it made.
Yeah.
Well, moving on from that, I mean, again, Life on Mars being a song that we could sit here and talk for hours and hours and hours about. But I do love this story. I was sitting at home listening to a Neil Young record, and I got a phone call that my son had been born. And I've always wondered, is there a Neil Young feel to Kooks?
There really is.
You think there is?
Oh, yeah.
Because I listened to it, even with this question in mind, I listened to it again this morning. And I don't know. I mean, there's a slightly high, reedy voice, which is very Neil Young.
Yeah.
But
well, okay, because he says this BBC session, the live BBC session he recorded for John Peel, just after his son Duncan had been born. And of course, in those days, it was quite unusual for dad to even be at the hospital, you know. So he tells the crowd at this live gig, and it's there on the, I think it's on the Bowie at the Beeb CD, isn't it? That people can hear. And he says, yeah, the hospital rang through the other day. I was listening to a Neil Young record, and they rang through to say that my wife had a baby boy, and I wrote this song. It is my contention that the Neil Young record he'd been listening to was After the Gold Rush, the album.
I was going to ask you, which one do you think?
There's a track on there called Till the Morning Comes, which is, if you listen to that track and have Kooks in your head, it's not identical. It's not a it has that sort of descending bass line. Yeah. It has a trumpet solo. It has those very similar sort of backing vocals, and it's just that the kind of ambiance of the song. It's a very sweet song, and yes, the vocal style a little bit. You know, Neil Young was always someone. I think we talked about this in one of our previous chats, didn't we? That, you know, Bowie was a great admirer of Neil Young right through. You know, they sort of bumped into each other every now and then later on tour.
Of course,
and
he covered I've Been Waiting For You. Yeah.
On Heathen, that's right.
So, Quicksand, I remember that 50th birthday party verse with Jim Smith. Did he play it often?
Well, no, that's very interesting, actually. Quicksand was a song that he performed it a few times on the later stages of the Ziggy Aladdin Sane tour in a little medley with Life on Mars and Memory of a Free Festival, oddly enough.
Really?
sort of bound up together.
Right.
We remember the sort of three-part medley on the famous Ziggy film, which is, what is it? It's Oh You Pretty Things, Wild-Eyed Boy from Free Cloud, and All the Young Dudes, of course, isn't it? Is that what it is? Yeah. But he did another little three-way medley, which included Quicksand. But after that, he didn't touch the song again until 1997. The first time he did it again was around about the time of his 50th birthday. He recorded a new version of it for a radio session and did this version with Robert Smith. Thereafter, took it on tour, on the Earthling tour, he played it frequently, and it was actually very often the opening number, and it became a rather wonderful opening number. Bowie always, whether he was doing a great big theatrical spectacular like Diamond Dogs or Glass Spider, or whether he was just doing a sort of straight-up band-type show, he liked to make an entrance and work out a way to, you know, come on good... And the way that it worked with Quicksand was really rather lovely. They did that old thing, a bit like the famous Talking Heads Stop Making Sense film, but in the space of one song. What happened was Bowie just came on with his acoustic and started doing Quicksand just like that. Mm. And then the band. One by one, the band came on, and then a bit of bass started, yeah, and then a bit of drums, and then Mike Garson started letting rip with his. And by the time you got to the, I think it's the second chorus or something, suddenly the whole band kind of really kicks in, and it suddenly lifted off into this great big sort of beautiful. It was a wonderful opening number. What a strange, what an interesting choice of opening number, particularly in that year of. You know, this was Bowie's famous drum and bass year. And he opens with with a beautiful acoustic band, quicksand going into a full band thing of that. Yeah, it was great. It was really lovely.
I'm glad he did. I mean, I do like that minimal version of, say, The Man Who Sold the World that cut around at the same time. And it would have been, maybe it wouldn't have worked quite so well if he'd done that with quicksand. But what a song to do. And what a song to just dig out at that point as well. I mean, it's so lyrically dense again. It's got so many of these metaphysical ideas contained therein. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, it's got that beautiful Rick Wakeman.
Yes, piano, yes, it's another one that,
which is just such a, just another dimension of perfection.
It's a very beautiful song, it's isn't beautiful. It? I mean, the whole album is beautiful, but there's a real sort of rich beauty about Quicksand that's really special.
And Rickman's playing in the outro as well. I love this piano solo.
It's really lovely. Yeah.
When Mick Jagger and Keith Richards used to talk about their pianist, Nicky Hopkins, they called him Diamond Tiaras because they were trying to describe around that time as well, around Sticky Fingers and everything, when they had these beautiful piano elements in their songs. How to describe Diamond Tiaras, these sort of like sparkling, shimmering curlicues and Baroque touches and flourishes, and that's very much what Rick Wakeman's doing here.
Yes.
Again, I think. And it's almost like the emotional outpouring of Quicksand is such a huge personal.
That's right. And we can't, of course, also, we have to acknowledge as well the very beautiful, and this is something we haven't mentioned at all with regard to this album yet, the very beautiful string arrangement on it. There's also a beautiful string arrangement on Life on Mars, and on a couple of the other tracks. And these are the work of a man we really haven't mentioned enough in this discussion yet, but I'm sure we will when we come to Queen Bitch, Mick Ronson, who, of course, went on to become Bowie's famous, sideman, lead guitarist in The Spiders from Mars. He's all over this album. He plays the lead guitar, but he was a classically trained musician, and these were his first, Bowie kind of encouraged him to go ahead and do some orchestral string arrangements for this album. And, he was very nervous about them because he hadn't done this sort of thing before. And, of course, famously...
How did he score Transformer, though?
Transformer hadn't been recorded yet. No. Transformer's summer of 72. That's not for another year. Right. Life on Mars was one of his first, big string parts. And Quicksand, another, And, of course... famously, when rock musicians get these posh orchestral sort of people in to, play their violins and their clarinets and whatever, it can be a bit of a culture clash, And
two words, Deep Purple.
And Woody Woodmansey, the drummer on the album, who of course also went on to stay for the Spiders from Mars, he has said, that Mick Ronson was really quite nervous about these, not least because, it was a known thing that if classical musicians came in to do their sort of string parts and things, they could sometimes get a little bit snooty about this sort of thing if the notation wasn't properly written out, and if these sort of who do these rock stars think they are, being all they don't know anything about music, but Mick Ronson was so meticulous and so good, and he was classically trained, so he didn't know how to do it. He knew how to do the dots, and. I mean, you just have to listen to those extraordinary sweeping strings on Quicksand or on Life on Mars. And on Fill Your Heart, actually, as well, on the next track. We'll come to that in a minute. Yeah. Beautiful, lilting strings. This is Mick Ronson, doing great, great work.
It's amazing. I mean, these days, especially looking at the state of the record industry in 2018, that an unsigned artist or an artist who is just, in the midst of changing contract... had the facilities to work with orchestras, to work with some of the best session musicians around. I mean, this album, we're talking about the lyrics, we're talking about the musicianship, but just consider that for a minute as well, is that what he had available to him. And this guy who'd really had one flop after another.
Yeah, yeah.
It was amazing that the amount of stock people had in him, the amount of faith people
that's
had.
That's absolutely right. These were people who really, clearly, really believed in him, And, I mean, it's... Of course, Ronson and Woody Woodmansey had been on The Man Who Sold the World as well. But it's not as though they all sort of stayed in the band. And, you know, after the, there was that period that they were all living at, famously, at Bowie's place in Beckenham at Haddon Hall, and they were kind of living, sleeping in sleeping bags up on the landing and things. But that was the Man Who Sold the World period. And after that, there's quite a long gap. You know, The Man Who Sold the World was finished, you know, the sessions finished in the spring of 1970. And then it's over a year before the Hunky Dory sessions started. And everyone went off, you know, Mick Ronson went back to Hull. And presumably thought, oh, that's that then. I, you know, went to see him again. Yeah. And he was, I think he was lining rugby pitches, but, you know, doing being the man who goes along with the white paint, you know, doing that sort of thing. And anyway, until he got the call from Bowie again. And yeah, it was by no means certain to begin with who was going to be on the album. You know, the bass guitarist at one point, Mick Ronson initially suggested a guy called Rick Kemp, who Ronson had played with on the Michael Chapman album a couple of years, a year or two before. Rick Kemp, a very good bass player, he came down to meet Bowie, and for whatever reason, that didn't happen. You know, according to legend, Tony DeVries, the manager with his eye on the marketing, vetoed Rick Kemp because of his receding hairline. I don't know, if that's true. If that were true, then neither you or I would have a chance with. But anyway, but it was that all ended fine, because what Rick Kemp did was he went off and joined the emerging folk rock group Steel Eye Span and is playing with them to this day. And nice, he's a very fine bassist. Yeah. Anyway, and then instead, Mick Ronson suggested his mate from a group called The Rats that he'd worked with before, Trevor Boulder, who of course was the last piece of the jigsaw of the band that became The Spiders from Mars. So that became the core band of Hunky Dory.
So it is a proto-Spiders band.
It is. It is. They're all there. They're all there. Yeah. The Spiders from Mars plus Rick Wakeman, essentially. Yeah.
And this is Rick Wakeman's version of Life on Mars, which, of course, he played on the original. And that was me and Nick Peck in the first part of our two-part episode on Hunky Dory. I really hope you enjoyed it. There's a lot more still to come, so I'll leave it there for now. Please do tune in again next week. Bye for now.